Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Elizabeth Denham. Elizabeth Denham is an author, marketer, and communications expert who helps people own their voice and strengthen their presence. She is the owner of Lotus Flower Media and co-owner of Writerspace, where she partners with businesses and authors to transform their stories into clear, compelling messages and strategic marketing that connects with audiences. Elizabeth also hosts the Gift of the Struggle podcast, where she explores how challenges can be reframed as opportunities for growth. With a career spanning publishing, marketing, and communications, she has developed a reputation for helping leaders and teams communicate with clarity and impact. An accomplished writer, Elizabeth is the author of Sweeten the Deal, Moving Day, and two accountability journals designed to inspire action and personal growth. She also wrote a blog for the Huffington Post for 5 years, contributing thought leadership on communication and personal development. Whether through her companies, her writing, or her speaking, Elizabeth focuses on turning struggles into strengths, building authentic connections, and helping people share their stories in ways that resonate. Elizabeth, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm excited to have you on the program today.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. I'm excited to be here, and I look forward to our conversation. I've been looking forward to it for a while.
Yeah, and I had the privilege of being a guest on your wonderful podcast, The Gift of the Struggle. And it was just a great experience for me. I think I reached out to you, and I don't usually do that often anymore, but I reached out to you because we had a mutual guest on my podcast and yours, Heidi Heumann. And
yes.
I reached out after listening to the podcast with Heidi. I read your bio and I said, let me reach out to Elizabeth and see if she might be interested in talking with me about potentially guesting on your podcast. And if there was alignment, we could do a podcast swap, which we're doing now. And here we are.
Yeah, here we are. And I was so glad when you did, because your story definitely resonated with me. And it's a transformative journey. I think those are the stories that matter and impact people and can help them get through things they think they can't.
Absolutely. And our life is defined by the challenges that find us. And it's again, I've said this on numerous podcasts, it's how we transcend them that defines the life that we're going to lead. And you are no stranger to challenge yourself, Elizabeth. So we're going to get into your story today. And I'm anxious for our audience to hear about your background, your story, and what we can learn from how you've transcended your challenges. So with that, my first question for you is, tell our audience about the experience or experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions today.
Well, sure. That's such a tough question because it could come from any direction. But I think, you know, in my adult life, a lot of unexpected things happened, which happens to most of us. But I found myself married with three kids and ended up entering a divorce that I did not plan on or expect due to decisions that I did not make. I felt very frustrated by that for years. I felt like my life changed dramatically because of someone else's choices that I had to react to, and only one way was possible. So that was an experience. No one in my family up to that point had been divorced, my immediate family. My parents had been married 56 years. That was just not something that I had experienced a lot of. And then at the same time, I kicked my husband out on Halloween. On Christmas, I got an earful of confession that I wasn't prepared for. In January, I filed for divorce. And in February, my youngest 2-year-old son started having seizures on the hour, every hour. So it was this perfect storm of everything in life feeling like it was just falling apart. But from that experience, it took years. It took a long time to sort of get to the point. But that little section of my life is what eventually launched the gift of the struggle. Because when you're in the midst of all of those things, there doesn't feel like a lot of gift, especially a sick child. I mean, there's no gift. There's no gift of a sick child. There's no gift of a loss of a loved one. Those are not the gifts, but the gifts come from surrounding situations that you learn from and you realize you can get through it. You can move forward from it and you can come out of the other side better for having gone through it. Not that you would ever wish it, but there are things to be learned and things that you can help other people learn through those experiences.
Oh, absolutely. And if anybody ever told me that something good came out of death of a loved one for me, I would tell them there's really nothing good about death. But what is the gift in the struggle with death, and as with any other challenges, what we learn from the challenges that are presented as a result of the trauma that's found us. And that's where the growth begins, not because of the event itself, but because of the challenges with it.
Right. And I think being on the other side of that, and obviously that's not the only challenge I've had in life, but it was one that I was kind of in charge of. Once you're in that early adulthood, if you have to navigate your own life, even if you have supportive family, you still have to be the one that overcomes all of those things. And so one thing that I think about now is there are times I don't know what the gift is going to be. But if I believe that it is there and eventually I will figure out what the gift of this particular situation is, it makes it a little bit easier to get through it. And I think instead of struggling through it, understanding that you can be curious about it and look at it and figure out, what am I going to get out of this situation? What do I need to learn? How can I look at it in a way that a little easier to take? How you frame the struggle during the struggle is as important as how you recover from it afterward. And so there are always things in life that are going to trip you up. But if you know that eventually you will have learned something and become out stronger or better, and I hate the phrase, that which doesn't kill you make you stronger. Because there was a period during that period where I thought, well, then I should be granted by now. I mean, how much struggle do I need to go through? Like, I'm a wall. I don't need to go through anymore. But so that's not what I'm trying to say. But I just think framing it in a way that you know that something is going to come from it that's not what you're going through in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was like the one thing that would have really kind of confused me and probably irritated me a bit after my daughter Janine transitioned or passed away or died, however we conceived death, is, well, God won't give you any more than you can bear. And I'm thinking, well, he already did. No parent should have to be dealing with a terminally ill child. It's unnatural. No parent should bury a child. When we get married, we anticipate that this is going to be one and done, that we are going to be married for life. I mean, I'm sure you didn't see a divorce coming. And I'm sure that had to, in a lot of ways, kind of cause you to rethink your priorities about relationships, about the permanency of relationships, the sanctity of marriage, and something like that. When it's unanticipated, when it defies the natural order of the universe, we can't help, Elizabeth, but not challenge what we already believe.
That's so true. And I think one of my friends was going through a divorce after I did, and she kept saying, I didn't get married to get divorced. And I said, nobody does.
Yeah.
None of us get married to get divorced. And for a while I was hung up on, like, I don't want to be a statistic. I don't want to be one of the 50% of people who get married. And that's just silliness. I mean, the things that get stuck in your head. But when you grow up in a family that has parents married for 56 years, and most marriages in my family had been long, whether they were good or bad is a different story. You know, like, some people may should have gotten divorced, not my parents, but you know, you don't think about those things. Yeah. And there's sort of a naivete to believing everything you do. You work hard, you do the right things, you make good decisions, and everything works out. That's just not the way life happens, right? Nope. And so I think being better informed and better prepared, and you're a little bit more mature in your life. When I got divorced, I was 33. and my children were 2, 4, and 6. So I was still relatively young. And I think the maturity of just life experience begins to at least prepare you for the ideas that you can do what you think are all the right things. You can work hard. You can make the best choices in the moment, and things still won't work out. And it's the same thing with losing someone in your life. There's no control over that. You know, we would like to be able to control all the things that happen to us. We don't get to do that.
Yeah, we don't. And living a good life, having a sense of right or wrong, treating your fellow human being with respect, with dignity, doesn't guarantee you're not going to go through challenge. Living a good life doesn't insulate us from the challenges that eventually befall us anyway. So, and I learned a long time ago that life isn't necessarily fair.
No, I mean, it's the last thing it is fair, really. Yep. But when you're able to have that crisis or whatever that is, and then come on the other side of it and look back and say, okay, in my situation, I learned that my children were very resilient. I learned I could handle more than I thought I could. My older two children learned empathy really young because they would come home from school and ask how their brother was doing. That's not common for 4 and 6 year old boys.
No.
I learned that I had a good network of people. I had friends who would show up at my door with dinner without even calling. They would just show up with dinner. You know, my mother came over routinely and helped me with the older two because I was so focused on the younger one that my only goal was to make sure they were clean and fed, which is a pretty low bar. And so she would come over and play with them or take them to their activities or, you know, do whatever needed to be done so that they didn't feel like they were just neglected during that time. Because as parents, you know, you do what you have to do and you focus on what you need to focus on. And so having that support system, my children grew up thinking of her really almost as a second mother. And that was a gift that may or may not have been quite so impactful without those situations. So I learned to appreciate those things. I learned to be glad that I could see those qualities in my kids. I think they've always been better able to prioritize what was a big deal than maybe they would have been without that experience. So I would never have wished that for my child or my family or any of my children. The divorce was very hard on all of them, but all are in very healthy long-term relationships. Nobody's married yet. They're 27, 25, and almost 23 now. But they've made good choices with relationships. They've gotten out of relationships they didn't need to be in. I don't think they have soured on marriage, which is a fear that you have, I think, as a parent. But I also know what a boundary looks like. So there are things that you can learn from by going through those realities. And without, you know, I wrote an article one time called Why My Divorce Made My Dreams Come True. I never thought I would have written that article when it happened. But because of that, I credit a lot of the things that have happened in my life. The fact that I write for a living wouldn't have happened. Where I live wouldn't have happened. I'm remarried, have a very happy, loving husband now. We've been married 13 years. That wouldn't have happened. So there are a lot of things that when you look back and you've realized what the gift is, I have a completely different life than I would have had otherwise. And I love it. I love my life now.
Yeah. And it sounds like, I mean, I can see the happiness just radiate from your face and you just look content and peaceful. And it sounds like whatever foundation you laid for your children at a young age after the divorce, they learned warmth, they learned empathy. You invited community as far as a means of support. So you modeled that for them, that it is okay to ask for help. That is, that we cannot get through challenges by ourselves, that we need our fellow human beings to get us there. And the fact of the matter is, they didn't sour on marriage. They made good decisions with relationships. They got out of relationships that weren't good for them. So whatever you did to lay that foundation, you provided, you know, between the community that you invited into your home and the resources that you provided, it sounded like they were able to thrive in spite of what had happened.
Well, thank you for that. I really think they have. And those parenting moments are some of the hardest ones you ever experience because you don't know what you're doing. One of the things my children are now learning is as they go through teenagers and young adult, they learn you're not perfect. That's a healthy thing for them to learn. But you know, when they're little, they expect that you know everything. And yes. I didn't know everything. And I did a lot of things that I hoped would work. But you know, I did communicate with them a lot. In my bio talks a lot about communication, but I did, you know, I'll never forget my 7-year-old. He was the oldest when we got divorced, was just very angry for a while. And he did not know how to express feelings at all. He is much better now, but when he was little, he was just very quiet and introspective. And he got mad at me and he was just angry with me all the time. And I just kept trying to talk about it. And one of the things I did was try not to put things in their heads that weren't there. So I didn't say, is this making you upset? Is that making you upset? Because I thought if I hit the nail wrong, I've introduced a new thing for him to worry about. Finally, he said, I said, Jake, this is just, we've got to talk through this. And he said, I'm just mad at time. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I'm with you for 2 weeks and dad for 2 days and you for 2 weeks and dad for 2 days. And his dad wasn't showing up in the way that he needed him to his events and school and activities and things. And so that's what he was really mad about. He was mad that his dad wasn't showing up, but he called it time. That felt, I think, less accusatory for him. And so I said, you've got to tell him that. Have you told him how you feel? And he said, no. And I said, well, you have to tell him. That's the only control you have over life. You need to tell him exactly how you feel. And so he did. He called him up and he told him, and his dad kind of skirted around the issue a little bit and didn't really understand what he was needing in that moment. And so when he hung up, I said, do you feel better? And he said, yes. And I said, do you think things are going to change? And he said, nope. And I said, well, why do you feel better? And he said, because I got to say it. And I don't think that was a one and done thing where for the rest of his life, he was a great communicator of his feelings. But I think it taught him to be empowered over his relationships a little bit. And so that's what I tried to always do. I tried to always empower my kids to, at the appropriate ages, communicate what they needed and what was bothering them and feel like they had power in their own voice. And, you know, that's not a straight line either, but I think that was kind of my strategy. And I think that's one thing that did help them navigate it and feel like it wasn't just something happening to them all the time.
And I think, you know, an early experience matters. We know the impact that divorce or any other type of traumatic events in early childhood have. And if early intervention or the bitterness or the anger or anything isn't addressed in a healthy way, that's going to tend to follow those children into adulthood and contribute to problems in their relationship, their self-esteem, their self-efficacy. But it sounds like you never let it get to that. You provided a safe place for them to talk. You answered their questions, but more so, you really empowered them to find their voice, which for individuals who have come from traumatic situations, hey, the people you've interviewed and I've interviewed, if we're going to look at a common ground, Elizabeth, is that they were empowered to find their own voice because of the struggles and the challenges that they had. But there are also other individuals that helped them find that, which again emphasizes the importance of community and not necessarily family.
Well, yes. And I think because my parents had stayed married for so long, it was a foreign experience to them too to support me through it. And so they were supportive, but they hadn't had that common experience. So finding other people who did, other women who were in a similar situation to me, and some of my closest friends, we would swap babysitting. One of my best friends was divorced. And every other Tuesday, we'd take each other's children so we could go to the grocery store or get our hair done or whatever, and just have a couple of hours. So building that kind of community of people who understood the same experience and understood how hard it was. You know, a lot of people don't think about that. One time I was driving home and it was in the evening and I was going to stop and get milk and Diet Coke. And I forgot. And I got home and I got everybody to bed and I just made a silly post on Facebook. And I was like, when you forget to buy milk and Diet Coke on the way home and you can't leave because the kids are all in bed, like as a single parent. And one of my other friends texted me and she's like, do you want me to go get you some milk and Diet Coke? I never thought about that part of hard of being alone and single. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, I can live without milk and Diet Coke. I was just griping. But it was funny because she said, I've never even thought of that because she had a husband and one of them would just run out and get it. And I'm like, once I was home, I was stuck and they were in the bed. Silly little things like that. But when other people see it and they, oh, that would make my life a little harder. Things like that matter in that community of friends and people who see your life for what it is and the difficulties that you're going through. makes it that much easier to do it.
Well, absolutely. It's sometimes it's just the little things that matter more than the big things. Just like having somebody, hey, you want to go out and get you what you need. And that's a powerful statement in and of itself.
Yeah. Even though I wouldn't have asked her to do that, but the fact that she even offered just made me feel good. That's really kind.
Yeah, you know, I was listening to you speak about raising your kids as a single parent for, through the divorce and everything. And my mother raised me as a single parent. My father had left when I was five. And I never saw her overwhelmed. She was very measured. She was very poised. But I have to ask you, I know you had a divorce, you had a sick child. And I also believe you moved twice in 3 years. Am I correct?
Yeah, we moved. We ended up moving from the house we lived with my husband in with my parents for a couple of years. And then we moved into our own place 3 years out. So, yeah, I mean, it was in relative close proximity, but it was still a big move each time.
Yeah. Was there a time that you just kind of thought, geez, it felt overwhelmed or that the struggle just wasn't worth the effort? I mean, were there just times where you just felt that way?
Oh, yeah, of course. Especially in the beginning stages. So there was a specific time. It was in January, you know, I had filed for divorce and I had to get all of my things in order. Like, I think there were mortgage payments that weren't paid. I had to get separate accounts. All of those things that you have to immediately to protect yourself, get in order. And my dad went around with me and we checked, was this bill paid? Was that bill paid? We went to the lawyer's office and I had to tell the whole ugly saga to the man that I didn't know. My dad helped me get my bills up to date, open a bank account and do all the things that you needed to do, which I had been capable of doing myself. But in that moment, I don't know if I was. And he went around with me and then my mom and he took my kids out to their house. They lived on a farm. So we were just going to go spend the weekend with them. They went and took my kids. I was home by myself gathering our things together and getting ready to go. And I never forget, I laid on the couch and just lost it. I think I cried harder than I'd ever cried in my entire life for a long time because it was humiliating. It was humiliating to have my dad take me around to all these places. It was humiliating that some of the bills weren't being paid and I didn't know it. It was humiliating to have to tell the story to the lawyer. You know, I mean, all of these things in one moment, in this one big day, we went and did all those things. And I just remember laying there thinking, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. Luckily, you know, my dad just walked me through it and he did it. And he told me what I needed to do and sign and, you know, helped me through that awful part of all the administrative things that come with divorce. I've not ever forgotten that, you know, hour on the couch by myself. I think it was the first time I'd really been by myself to have that moment and I needed to do it. But it was that moment where I felt all of those things.
Yeah, and I know a lot of things that you did with your kids, I know, helped them, you know, get through, you know, the challenges of the divorce. Is there anything that you did additionally for yourself to help you get through those moments where you felt overwhelmed, besides, you know, reaching out to your dad or other members of the community? Was there any other resources that helped you during those times?
Well, I definitely went to therapy for about 3 years. So that was one thing. We were going to therapy together and then he just quit going when I filed. And so I kept going for 3 years and it was just helpful to have that space where nobody else knew what I was saying or thinking or feeling. And I got a lot of advice on my kids. I used him as a resource to help me through what is an appropriate thing to tell them, what's too much. That helped me navigate it. So I did do that, but I also played tennis. I had just started playing for about a year before all of that happened. And that was as good a therapy as the therapist, I think. I could just go out there and play in a group with a bunch of women and hit the heck out of a ball. And then, you know, exercise is one of the things that helps me manage stress to this day. And I always joke that made me really good at tennis because I could knock the heck out of that ball and I was focused. And it was this hour and a half that I got to myself. They had a nursery so I could put the boys over there. If I didn't work out, I always felt worse. So to this day, that's one of the things. I walk now because I'm older. And I play pickleball, but I don't do the same kinds of things I used to do when I was young. But that is therapy for me.
Yeah, I think movement, any type of exercise can really help. And it's helped me, you know, whenever, you know, that I have a routine first thing in the morning where most mornings I'll exercise. you know, ride the recumbent bike or do the elliptical. Mm-hmm. And that just releases any stress I may have experienced from the day before. And it just puts me in a good frame of mind to be productive, to do what I need to do, to be present for family, to be present for my podcast guest contributors and for my students. So I learned that probably about 5 or 6 years ago, about the age of 66, I learned that I needed to not treat my body like an amusement park and quit putting funny stuff in it. And I had to treat it like a temple, really put healthy stuff in it. So, you know,
I think that's true. And I was a ballet dancer for 30 years. And so I just had it built into my life and I didn't realize how valuable it was until I got older and had more stress. And then I thought, this is how I survived my life. You know, and for me, the dance was such a mental thing because it's hard. It's mentally hard to remember everything and to keep yourself the way you need to hold your body and all those things. But it's also physically demanding. So It was like this hour of almost a meditative thing where you escaped your brain. You focused really, really intensely for an hour and a half, and then you went about your life. And so as I aged and couldn't do that as much anymore, my kids got busy, and I danced until I was 37. And then, of course, had a knee replacement last year at the ripe old age of 53. I was 53 when I had it, which is not normal. So I've had to find alternatives. And that's been a challenge just because I don't want to continue to damage my body in the way that I did. So I walk a lot and I play the pickleball and I can do yoga and things like that. So it's been, but nothing has been as mentally distracting as the dance was. So finding alternatives that help my mental as much as it helps my physical has been a little bit of a difficult thing for me.
Well, and dance is therapeutic. It's not only good exercise, but it works well with individuals who have had anxiety, who maybe are a little or hyperactive. It kind of just centers them, it grounds them, and it's just movement in motion is really helpful for a lot of individuals to get through challenge anyway, particularly young adults.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Elizabeth, I want to switch focus for a bit. I want you to tell our audience about your book, Sweeten the Deal, How to Spot and Avoid the Big Red Flags in Online Dating. That sounds like that's going to be an interesting read. And your children's book, Moving Day, Overcoming the Fear of Change, and what you want readers to take away from them.
Sure. So Sweeten the Deal is basically a limited memoir of 6 to 8 years of online dating that I did after I got divorced. And it's a humorous kind of memoir at my own expense because you just can't make it up. And my dates were so ridiculous. So the chapter titles are things like The Criminal, The Wanna Feel My Muscle Guy, Cry Baby Cry, Who Cried Over a Bucket of Beer on a First Date, Tricky As, AZZZ was one guy's handle. And he wrote about the way you would expect someone who would use that handle to, right? So anyway, I tell the stories, but I also talk about the big red flags of, you know, in categories, who's not ready to date, those who are not ready to date, who shall never be ready to date. He who is not over his last relationship, things like that. So I try to make it funny, but it's also got some practical tips in there, like how you look at dating. And one of the ways I talk about looking at dating is saying, just because someone doesn't want to go out with you again, or you don't hit it off with somebody, doesn't make you a bad person. It just means you're not a good fit. Because so to that point, Tricky asked, recognized that we might not be a good fit. He was a biker guy and just a whole different lifestyle than mine. And he wrote to me and he said, I know we're not a good fit, but would you help me write my profile? And I thought about it for a while and I was like, well, I guess I could help him. And then I thought, nope. And I wrote him back and I said, here's the thing. Like attracts like. And if you are not fully yourself, you are not going to attract the person that you're going to want. So I don't want to help you write your profile. Your profile is fine just the way that it is, because there's somebody out there for everybody. And to go in there and manufacture a profile that I would have helped him write would not have been attracting the right person for him. So I think going into it, I talk to my kids a lot about dating fully formed humans. There's no such thing at 27, like my children are. They've got to be forming in the right direction. Yes. But when you're older, you can look for a more fully formed human. Somebody who knows their moral character, knows what they want in life, knows what kind of relationship they want. Somebody who's figured out most of the things about themselves and their character. And so if you are dating fully formed people and you don't mesh with somebody, it's not a flaw necessarily. And I always said, don't give, people would want a list of, well, what's wrong with me? Maybe I can improve for the next person. I'd be like, no, that's not what this is. This is, we're not a good fit. And it's not up to me to give you a list of critiques. Maybe we just have a personality conflict, or maybe we don't want the same things out of life, or whatever it is. It doesn't have to mean that somebody, there's a fatal flaw. Sometimes there is. Sometimes they're just big fat liars.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's really not for you. Why even bring that into the conversation? We're just not a good fit at the end. So I think looking at those things for what they are, and I had a mantra in the book too, that you have to really date with the idea that I'd rather be alone for the rest of my life than be with the wrong person, and mean it. Because if you don't mean it, you're going to just keep going down these paths that are wrong for you, or you're going to settle for something that's not really what you want. And so it's a hard thing to mean if you would really rather have a relationship. But if you have deal breakers and you've articulated these things are deal breakers for me, but they don't actually break your deal, then you end up in these cycles of one bad relationship after the other. So I would tell my one friend who was just always thinking she was going to marry people, if your deal breaker doesn't break your deal, then you're the one, you know, it's predictive of your not relationship not working out.
Yeah. And you mentioned too that there are some people that are so fearful of being, I'm paraphrasing, so fearful of being alone that they'll settle for anything. And that's like Einstein's definition of insanity, is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And for me, if something happened where after 43 years, my wife got sick of me and kicked me out of the house, I wouldn't even begin to know where to start. So I might have to read your book just to see what you went through and just try to figure out. But I'm not going to do the online dating thing. But
if you want to chuckle.
Yeah. I mean, we could all use a dose of humor in our lives, you know, particularly in this day and age. So
if you need nothing more than a laugh, it's a funny read.
Well, and I mean, wisdom is learning from other people's mistakes or other people's experiences as opposed to our own, or in addition to our own. So now, what about Moving Day, the children's book, Overcoming the Fear of Change? How did that evolve, and what do you want readers and their families to take away from it?
So my sister and I did that book. My sister is an illustrator, and growing up, she had an imaginary friend, and her imaginary friend's name was Lisa Merry-Go-Round. And so when we decided to do this book together, I wrote most of the story based on her imaginary friend, and she did all of the illustrations, and we made a boy character called Tommy Seesaw. And it's a book that streams from reality to imagination and back to reality again, as it does with children with imaginary friends. Two of my children had imaginary friends. One of them had three imaginary friends, and Jack, John, and John. He was very original. And then he weirdly passed them down to his brother, who adopted Jack, John, and John. The third one didn't buy into this. So he didn't have any. So we wanted to just plug into that imaginary friends a lot of kids have. And we decided to just make it. The idea is that it would become a series, and we haven't had time to really do more than one at this point. But it's how a couple of children use imaginary friends to overcome a move to a new town, and how those imaginary friends help them assimilate into their new house and their new community, and they feel less alone. So it just plays with imagination. And one of the favorite parts for me of that story is that the little girl mispronounces the word imagination and calls it her magic nation. And so when we ever do book two, it will be a series called the Magic Nation series that's imaginative.
Well, imagination and this magic nation, I mean, there's not that far of a jump.
No, it's really not.
I got to love the imagination of kids and their creativity. And there's a lot going on beneath the surface, particularly as they're developing their verbal skills. There's still a lot going on.
For sure. And my one sister had the imaginary friend, and my other sister got tired of the imaginary friend. And at some point, kicked her out of the house. She kicked Lisa Merry-Go-Round out and shut the front door. And my younger sister never saw her again. That was the end of it.
So closes that chapter.
Funny. Like, it's so funny that you didn't just let her back in. Just open the door and let her back in.
Yeah,
I guess she was ready to move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a lot of real life utility in that piece, too. So I think I saw this on your website that in your first book, you allude to those who fail to embrace their own reality.
Mm-hmm.
Expound on that statement just a little bit and tell our audience why embracing our reality is essential to transcending life challenges.
Yeah, well, I noticed in dating particularly, I guess because I had a lot of dates in a somewhat limited period of time, that there were a lot of people who did not understand where they were in their own journeys. And one that comes to mind specifically was a guy who was military and had been in war zones and very clearly had some PTSD.
Yeah.
And he had to sit with his back to the wall and he had to sit near the window and he was constantly scanning like someone with PTSD would. I'm watching all of this, I'm not in any professional in the subject matter, but it was very evident to me what he was doing. And so that was one thing he did not have the self-awareness about or had not fully overcome or dealt with yet. The other thing he did was he kept saying, my wife, I mean ex-wife, my wife, I mean ex-wife. And I was like, you are so not ready to date. And it was like he was still in denial that this had happened to him. And I wanted to say, I mean, we knew each other for 5 minutes over coffee, but I just wanted to say, you've really got to work to the point of acceptance. And in order to do that, you can't pretend like it's not happening, which was what I felt like he was doing. Or one of the things about the gifts of the struggle, and you recognize that there will be gifts in whatever form they come, no matter what. That to me helps lay the goal for walking through the struggle or the pain or the trauma or whatever it is, instead of avoiding and going around. And, I had a friend today who actually, her job was eliminated this morning, and she called me and she's like, I feel like I need to do all these things. I've got to look for a job. I got to do my resume. I got to do this. I got to do that. And I was like, I think you should take today and just take your day off. I think you need to feel crappy all day long and have grief and not make big decisions in the midst of this news,
mm-hmm.
and give yourself whatever that is, that time, and then with a clear head, make better decisions the next day or whatever it is. So I think a lot of us, nobody wants to go through pain. Nobody wants to go through trauma. But if you don't embrace it. And to me too, if you allow yourself to really hold it and embrace it and go through it, you're going to get to those gifts faster because you're going to understand what it's giving to you as much as it is taking away from you.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we can embrace the anger, we can embrace mm-hmm. the sadness, and then just say, okay, I'm going to embrace this for a period of time, learn from it, let it go, and move on to make the best possible day I can under the circumstances I've been dealt with. That is the way to live our life. And I mean, I tried to deny my own reality that I was a bereaved parent. After 2 years of grieving the physical absence of my daughter, I just said, I've had enough of this. I don't want to be a bereaved parent anymore. I want my life back. So I stopped going to support groups. I tried to immerse myself in work. And I ended up feeling more miserable because I denied that part of that reality that, though it wasn't anything that I ever willingly embraced, was a part of who I was now. And if I didn't acknowledge that, I would have stayed stuck.
For sure. I mean, you have to. And it's funny how we avoid labels. Like, I didn't want to be the statistic of a divorced person.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be divorced. That word was just really horrible to me. You don't want to be a bereaved parent. You don't want to be living with grief that never goes away. You know what I mean? Those labels can be the very things that we avoid. And it's not about the label. It's about navigating the feeling and the experience and the movement forward. And what are you going to do with that? And a lot of the time that feels really horrible for quite a while.
Yeah.
But if you don't go through it, so I have another friend, I interviewed her actually on my podcast too. She has a chronic cancer and it's treatable. And right now she's in remission, but it's one of those kinds of cancers that will never go away and she will never live completely cancer free, right? And so we talked a lot about the aftermath of a cancer diagnosis when you survive and are expected to live for a decently long period of time. But knowing every single day that it could come back and probably over the course of her life will. And so how do you live and not be paralyzed by fear?
Yes.
It's an answer she doesn't completely have yet, but she talked a ton about her community of medical doctors, her medical team, her church people, her friends and family. She's got a lady that she's been walking with in the morning for years, like since her children were little and her children are 30s. That was one of the big things that was keeping her going through all this and still allowing herself the days to feel the grief of stability. I mean, we all know we could get hit by a bus tomorrow, but when you live with a chronic illness or a chronic cancer, it just is in your face more every day. So how do you live a full, happy life? And I will tell you, my son, when he was in the sixth grade, his best friend's dad got cancer. And it was one of those that was just going to be quick. It was a colon cancer. And he had a genetic condition that guaranteed that he was going to get it. And now he has since died, but the two sons have that same gene. So now they saw what was coming for them. But I was telling my husband, we did not know each other at the time. It was a lesson in how to die for me to watch them, because he lived the fullest life of anyone I've ever seen who knew he was going to die. I think he was given about 12 months to live and he lived for maybe 18. They went and did trips that he had always wanted to take. He sang in the church choir until the weekend before he died. He did things with the kids. He showed up to every single thing. I watched them and just thought, this is remarkable. This is the most remarkable thing I've ever seen, that they really embraced living. And every day that he was capable of doing, he did. And I just thought, if I ever had to experience something like that, I would hope I would be able to live and to die in the way that he lived, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, Maury Schwartz said, once you learn how to die, you learn how to live.
Right. Yeah, it was an amazing lesson for me to watch. And then that was how Jake learned how to be a friend. This is my quiet one who wasn't great at expressing emotion. When I saw the post, we were all kind of watching for the Facebook post when it was coming near and we knew it. And I saw it come up and I said, Jake, you've got to call William. And he's sixth grade. He said, I don't know what to say. And I said, all you're going to do is you're going to call him and you're going to say, William, do you need me?
Yes.
And he said, that's it. And I said, that's it. And if William needs you, he will say yes. And if he doesn't, he'll say no and you'll be fine either way. And William said yes. And so Jake went over there and they played video games all day because that's what William needed to do. He's like, well, what do I say or do? I say, you say, I'm very sorry, you know, and he knew his dad, very sorry for your loss. And then ask him what he wants to do. And William needed to play video games that day.
Yeah,
that's what he needed to get through the day, because everybody was coming into the house and dealing with his mom and all the awful stuff that goes with that. William needed to be sixth grade boy playing with his friend.
Yeah.
And so I think those lessons, you learn so much and, you know, try to use that to teach your kids how to navigate those things and be better people, and helping Jake embrace William's need in that moment and doing what needed to be done, because that wasn't easy for him to go over there either, but he needed to do it for his friend, you know.
Yeah, especially for a child. It's really hard. It's hard for an adult to know how to be present for somebody in grief, or much less for a child. But it's just basically, what do you need from me now? And if it's playing video games, it's playing video games. If it's doing something else that is going to normalize what they're going through, you do that. It's the person who is grieving drives the bus. So we be present for them in a way that they need us to be most present.
Yeah. Yeah, and hopefully Dick learned that lesson. I think he's turned out to be a decent friend.
I think so, too. Well, he's got a decent mother, too, so you've got to give yourself some credit. You did a great job as a single parent raising your children through some really tough times, and you've instilled some great values in them that are going to just make them great citizens and are going to make me secure in the future of the United States of America as long as we have young adults like your children, so...
Oh, thank you. That's what gives me hope, too. I'm like, at some point, y'all are taking over, so good luck.
So I tell my students, I said, you know, the baby boomers have kind of screwed this up. So I said, it's your turn now to just make this world what we've always envisioned it to be.
Yeah, no pressure.
No pressure. I just put no pressure on you. Just the fate of the universe is in your hands, but I know you can handle it. So
embrace your own reality.
Yes, embrace your own reality. Very good. I'll quote you on that the next time I have class.
Yeah.
We've been talking about your podcast. So why don't you tell us about the Gift of the Struggle podcast? What inspired it? And what you want your audience to take away from it?
Well, so the Gift of the Struggle was inspired by my son and the seizure disorder. And when he was 2 years old, I wrote an article several years after that, that just talked about the gift of the struggle and what we all learned from it and how we navigated that situation and into a place where we could live with it. He had epilepsy from 2 to 12, and then he outgrew it. So it was a long haul. It was something, interestingly, he doesn't really remember it. He's almost 23. And I asked him recently if he remembered any of it. He said no, which I think is a blessing. But I was like, really? Because it consumed my brain for like 15 to 18 years, because I didn't stop thinking about it just because he'd outgrown it for a long time. So it was inspired by that, just what, how you learn to navigate something like that and what the gifts are and having the ability to recognize those. So I started interviewing people who had been through serious struggles or traumas, or, and it could be anything from my financial stress to financial loss, to a loss of a loved one, to the loss of your security of life that you believe it to be, or it could be anything. And I've talked to some really outstanding people about stories of overcoming and reframing the story of their struggle. And what I hope to do with that is allow other people to bear witness to these stories and say, maybe if they did that, I can do that. Or, and I think one of the nicest things anyone ever said, I interviewed a woman in her 30s, and it was right after COVID. She had COVID really badly. Her brother died of a terminal illness during that time frame, but he was supposed to have lived a lot longer. So it was an unexpected death. I think she lost a grandparent during the same time. She was just a really lovely woman. I said, I'd love to interview you. And she said, I'm not ready, but I'll let you know when I am. So 3 months later, she reaches out to me. I didn't even have to follow up. And she said, I think I'm ready now. And she said, it didn't even occur to me that there could be a gift in the struggle until you said that. And she said, that got me thinking about what are the gifts of my struggle. And her gift ended up being that it was okay not to be okay. She needed to accept that it was okay not to be okay for as long as she needed to get through all of those multiple traumas at one time. And that was a gift to me, because she hadn't thought she could frame it differently, that there could be gifts in all of those things. And even if the gift is sort of a sad gift, it's okay not to be okay, but sometimes you need to be allowed not to be okay.
Yes.
So I was very touched that she said that. But those are the kinds of things I hope people can gain from it. And some inspiration or affirmation that in the worst times of your life, there is another, there is the end. There is the getting through it, and there is the recovery, and the journey doesn't have to end there.
And as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, we met through me listening to your podcast with Heidi Heumann and me being a guest on your podcast. One of the things that you do so well as a host is that you just allow the stories to unfold. You ask really good questions. You don't want superficial conversations. You want to really get into it. And you ask the questions, you allow the answers to evolve. And it's just a really safe platform for individual stories to evolve. So I know I felt comfortable. And I know watching you interview Heidi with her challenges, you did a really great job just allowing her story to evolve. So you got one big fan right here of your podcast. So.
Well, thank you. I really do appreciate that. I try to find interesting people. And without the interesting guests, you don't have a good podcast. So the fact that you're willing to talk about it, and I know it is healing. It's healing to continue to talk about these things. And it makes you feel like there's some more added meaning and value to the experience that is otherwise not something you ever hoped to live through. So I appreciate guests like you and Heidi who are willing to share such intimate stories and share them with the world to give people hope.
Well, and for me, it's like sharing my story. I think if it helps one person, then I've done my job for that particular day. And there isn't anything for me to gain by not telling my story. I pride myself on being transparent and an open book, and stories are healing. And my narrative continues to change as I evolve every day. And the thing with human development is that growth doesn't stop when we get to a certain age. Mm-hmm. It's going to continue until, for me, I start, as I call it, affectionately dancing in another dimension. I'm still going to grow in this lifetime until it's my time to expand my existence somewhere else. So I'm going to continue to learn as much as I can learn for as long as I'm allowed to do it.
Yeah, I think that's the whole point, right? That's the whole point of everything that we have to go through and we get to go through.
Absolutely. One of my last questions for you today, Elizabeth, if there's one ultimate wisdom or one ultimate takeaway you could leave our audience with today, what would that be?
You know, for me, it's really that believing that there is a gift, even in the worst situations, even in the hardest situations, there can also be beauty. There can be hope. All you have to do is sometimes just look up and see who's out there reaching a hand out.
Yeah, and sometimes the people who reach their hands out are those people that we least expect to reach their hands out, but it's whoever is there for us at that particular moment, not who isn't there.
That's exactly right, and focusing on that is key.
Absolutely. And now I'm going to give you an opportunity to promote yourself a little bit. If people want to purchase your books, they follow your podcast, contact you, what's the best way for them to do that, Elizabeth?
So thegiftofthestruggle.com houses my podcast and some writings that I do. My books are on Amazon, so you can just go look me up, Elizabeth Denham on Amazon for Sweeten the Deal, and all those books will come up. My social media is all at The Gift of the Struggle. My marketing information is at lotusflowermedia.com.
And I'll make sure all that information gets into the episode notes when our podcast goes live. So with that, Elizabeth, thank you so much for spending time with me today. I enjoyed our conversation, and I hope we can do it again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.